You're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide, KAOS959.com. As the American Bill of Rights disappears, the state and TV do all they can to remind us of the ubiquitous terrorist threat. However, since 9/11, there have been quite a few terrorism cases in the United States that have turned out to be quite a bit thinner than the state had first alleged. Joining me this half hour is Becky Akers. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks. And everybody, Becky writes regularly for the very libertarian LouRockwell.com, and her article, When the Devil Creates a Devil, is running at the top of the viewpoints section today at antiwar.com. Now, Becky, this article discusses a case that, contrary to most of these others, has not gotten very much publicity at all, the case of Shahawar Matin Siraj.
That's right.
23, who 1 week ago was sentenced to 30 years in prison for conspiring to blow up the 34th Street subway station in New York City.
That's right.
And now apparently his family is being deported as well.
This case should greatly concern all of us. First of all, there's the humanitarian interest of here's a young man and his family who've been totally demolished by the U.S. government. Secondly, it should concern us for our own safety. If the government can do this to an immigrant family with very little resources and, you know, very little armor against the government, what can they do to the rest of us? Yes, we may have a little more resources than they do. We may be able to hire better attorneys, or we may know people, but still, this is really showing us the government's powerful fist and how it could be aimed against all of us. Our families, too, could be rounded up once we're arrested for whatever reason. And remember, you know, it used to be that you had to do something pretty drastic to be arrested. Thanks to the Patriot Act and much of the other legislation that's been passed since 9/11, many of us are now criminals.
And don't even know it, perhaps.
You may not even know it. Many of us could have already been searched. Our files, our computer can be searched, our home can be ransacked, and the cops no longer have to tell us. In fact, you can be penalized for divulging as a librarian that your client's records have been requested by the feds. So all of us are targets in this, and, you know, government always starts off with the helpless among us and preys on them. That's what's happened with this family.
Well, now, these are very serious charges. I mean,
yes, they are.
We're talking about allegedly, or, well, I guess we're not supposed to say allegedly, he's been convicted, a plot to bomb a subway station in New York City.
That's right. Basically, what happened was this is a young guy. He was an immigrant in his early 20s. From Pakistan. He was living in Queens and working at his uncle's Islamic bookstore in Brooklyn. Not surprisingly, he would talk politics with others in the store, you know, other customers who came in and the staff and everything. He met an older man in his 50s who took a real interest in him. And this guy would even drive him home from the store from Brooklyn to Queens. Now, that's a big deal. For those of you who don't live in New York City, it's, you know, there are no direct trains that go from Brooklyn to Queens, and there are very few buses as well. So it's a very long trip, even though they're just next door. You've got to basically make a huge, enormous U, and it can take hours. If you're in a car, it takes 20 or 40 minutes, depending on traffic. So, you know, again, this may seem a very small thing, he gave him a ride home, but if you live in New York, you know what that involves. He would take him to the mosque that was next door to his uncle's bookstore to pray, and apparently Siraj had not gone to this mosque before. Now, I've read conflicting reports about this. In fact, much of what I'm telling you, depending on what source you're consulting, it's going to vary slightly. So he would take him to the mosque to pray. He even offered him a ticket home to Pakistan so that Siraj could find a wife. So at any rate, this guy is also holding himself out to be a real expert in Islam. And he, you know, is spiritually mentoring a young man who apparently didn't have too much interest in it prior to that. About 8 months into the friendship, this guy starts taping their conversations because he's been working the entire time undercover for the New York Police Department. And he's been striking up this friendship and taking such an interest in Siraj simply because the police department decided this young man was a threat and a terrorist, and they set out to find evidence of that. The older man's name is Elda Woody. Elda Woody shows Siraj pictures of the American atrocities in Iraq. He makes up some stuff, but a lot of what he showed him was pictures from Abu Ghraib and other, true incidents that he's showing him simply to inflame him. Siraj then comes up with a plan to bomb the Herald Square subway station after his mentor, Elder Woody, praised a plan that some other young man had come up with to blow up the bridges leading to Staten Island. So, all the way along, he's being carefully set up. He's being coached in how to respond. And as any of us would, when talking to a friend, Siraj is seeking to establish common ground with this older man who seems to really be into Islam, who seems to be outraged at all these atrocities, who is saying to him, do you think we ought to do something? And Siraj says, yeah, we've got to do something to defend our people. This is terrible. Now, is this entrapment? Siraj came up with the plan by himself, apparently, to bomb the Herald Square subway station. It's very interesting. After he came up with his plan, he wavered quite a while about it. He'd one day be hot on it and the next day be cold. He told Elder Woody at one point he had to ask his mom if it was all right. He tried to back out of it.
He told the informant that he had to ask his mom
That's
if it
right.
was okay.
That's right. We're dealing again with a young man who doesn't seem to have a whole lot on the ball. He seems to have been fairly, I don't want to say sheltered, but he just doesn't seem to have made a lot of the connections most guys his age would. He seems very trusting and childlike in a lot of ways. And his mother and uncle and everyone in the family, as well as his attorney, have all said he's just not all there upstairs. So that's also very troubling.
So now, what we're talking about here, ultimately, or so far anyway, what we see here is a government informant who's being paid more than $100,000.
That's right.
Who finds the stupidest kid in the bookstore.
Right.
To see if he can trick him into saying something incriminating on tape, basically.
There you go.
Now, this kid is not—he's not a criminal. He hasn't been to Pakistan or to train in a madrasa or anything, right?
That's right. That's right. And in common law tradition as America has, you have to have two things to have a crime. You have to have the mens rea, you have to have the motivation. You also have to have the actus reus, which means you have to have some kind of action to accompany that. Because all of us have bad thoughts from time to time. All of us have had somebody we've wanted to kill or we've been wronged and we're going to get them or whatever. You have to take action on that. It's interesting to me in the war on terror and actually the drug war and a bunch of other so-called wars, the government is increasingly getting away from that second qualification. There are lots of thought crimes out there now, and that basically seems to be what Siraj is guilty of, thought crime. And again, these thoughts planted by a government informant. Now, when Siraj was arrested, he was arrested a couple of days before the 2004 Republican National Convention, and he had a map of the Herald Square subway stop on him. That supposedly indicates that he was reconnoitering it and he wanted to bomb it, and that's why he had this map in his possession. Can we call that an actus reus? I don't think so. You probably could find people who will argue, yes, we can. But what I would say to them is, look at what this case is hinging on. Look at what has been done to entrap this young man. We can live in a perfectly safe society where we are preventing terrorism, giving the police face value here and saying, okay, this guy is a bona fide terrorist. You didn't egg him on. He would have come up with this all on his own. Okay. Is this the kind of society we want to live in, where we're turning each other in, where, remember this Elda Woody, the government informant, is attending this neighborhood mosque daily. He is sending daily reports from the mosque. He is concentrating on Siraj, yes, but he's also spying on everybody else there. Would any of us like to go to church and know that the guy in the pew next to us could be a government informant? Elder Woody at one point wrote down the license plate numbers of cars in the mosque parking lot. Is this the kind of society we want to live in, where you go to the gym and you wonder, the gal next to me on the treadmill, is she going to report that I was here? Has she been writing down my license plate number and giving it to the FBI? This is what's involved in preventing terrorism, and this is what the NYPD wants us to think is good work. And, in fact, it's fascinating to realize that the police undercover work that went on in this case, this is the first one that has come to trial for this counterterrorism unit that has been functioning at the NYPD. So there was a lot of official focus on this, even though there hasn't been that much public attention to it. This case is seen widely in official circles as justifying this enormous counterterrorism unit the NYPD has set up. Now, that's being done on my taxes, and a lot of your taxes, too, that come back to New York. The NYPD counterterrorism unit went from under 20 guys before 9/11 to anywhere from 1,000 to 4,000 today. I have found conflicting figures, and I'm sure that's deliberate. They've got guys stationed overseas reporting back to the NYPD. They've got these guys out there. Ray Kelly, who is the police commissioner here, brags that they are on 24/7 surveillance. They work 12-hour shifts. Basically, they're probably aware that we're talking right now. You know, I mean, you've got this whole department with not much to do. And so I think you're going to continue to see cases like Siraj's come to the forefront as these guys desperately scramble to find stuff that justifies their existence and their enormous budget.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and I'm talking to Becky Akers from LouRockwell.com. And her article is featured, actually, today on Antiwar.com. When the devil creates a devil. And I guess if I can make the devil's case here, what we're talking about is a massive death and destruction if this kid's successful. And
right.
So, okay, maybe we don't live up to all your funny little qualifications from ancient English common law, but after all, we're talking about people who ultimately are willing to die themselves in order to kill other people, and the English back in the days when that common law was written never had to deal with that problem.
That's right, and it's interesting to me when I read the different proposals put out, especially here in New York, to fight terrorism. It's fascinating to me that nobody ever suggests, why don't we bring our troops home? Why don't we quit making enemies around the world that hate us so much because of what we have done in their countries, because of the troops and the barracks that we have established on what they consider to be holy ground in Saudi Arabia? Why don't we bring these guys home and quit running other countries' business? Maybe the rest of the world wouldn't hate us then. You never see that. You don't see any call to go back to the Constitution, which never, ever empowers the feds to do anything like this. You know, and then look at what's been going on in this Muslim community in Brooklyn, where this undercover agent lived and worked for 2 years. And apparently this community is riddled with informants. I read one interview with a woman there who said, yeah, we know who they are. She said, they think that we're all stupid. They think we don't notice they come here and move in suddenly. They have no family. They have no friends. And yet they're just there at the mosque all the time. Now, what does that do to immigrants who are here? They've fled persecution in their country. They have fled police informants in their country. They come here and they think they're in a free country and boom, they've got the same stuff all over again. So you talk about why these guys want to kill us, and they're willing to do it. They want to do it so badly, they're willing to die for it. Why would that be? Is it possible that we are bringing that on?
Oh, I think it's just a poisonous misinterpretation of Islam.
Oh, that could well be. I'm not an Islamic scholar, and I'm not going to argue. You know, I've read arguments both ways on that. And
well, I was just kidding. It's clearly the foreign policy.
Yeah. To me, I just don't see how anybody... I mean, think if we had a bunch of Islamic soldiers here in this country. If we had Islamic soldiers in our churches and synagogues, what would we think of Islam? And then we wonder why these people hate us. What we need to do is get back to the Constitution that does not authorize the federal government to regime change or to interfere in other countries' business. And we need to realize that as long as we do that, we're going to be paying the price for it.
Now, you implied something a little bit earlier there when you talked about the New York Police Department's counterterrorism unit.
Right.
You almost seemed to be implying that rather than being disinterested, you know, adjudicators of justice and so forth.
Oh, right.
That these people actually have their own motivations and interests?
They absolutely do. And any government does. I don't mean to single just them out. Any government anywhere in the world does. I think that's one thing where Americans are extremely naive. We seem to think that because we've been fed this pabulum about how we vote for our officials and we're a democracy, which of course everyone knows is untrue, somehow our government is different from all the others. But it isn't. Government is always force. No matter what time we're talking about in history, no matter what country we're talking about, government is in its essence force, and it is force brought against those people who don't go along with what the rulers say. So for us to think that we're somehow blessed with a democratic government, it's like, look at what your government just did to this family. The son is basically put away for 30 years. His family is going to be deported. And that, again, is a real warning sign of what's going to start regularly happening. And all of us should be terrified by this, because this has been a prohibition in common law for centuries. You don't punish a family. If there is a criminal in the family, if somebody has murdered in that family, you take that person. You don't go after the family and extirpate the whole family. That's what the government has done in this case.
And actually, in your article, you quote biblical verses to that effect, right?
That's absolutely right. This has been, you know, throughout Western history, this has been a prohibition that the person bears their own wickedness, their own sin, and they take that penalty on themselves. But it's not extended under any system of justice to a family.
And that's actually embedded in the American Constitution itself. I guess the only crime that they contemplate where a family would be punished is the crime of treason. And they say specifically in there that you cannot punish anyone else in the family or seize any property or anything else.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, I wanted to bring that into the article, but it isn't quite exactly what I was talking about, but it is a fascinating corollary. In English law, if somebody were convicted of treason, that person's property could be taken from them and their family was not allowed to inherit it or to get it back. Well, obviously, King saw a very quick way to get rich here, so not surprisingly, there were tons and tons of treason cases being brought, and a lot of the nobility was being deprived, and other people, too, being deprived of their land. So that eventually was prohibited in England, and it made its way into the American Constitution as well, that when somebody is convicted of treason, that person's property may not be taken away, and the family's property may not be taken away from them. I'm sorry, the person's property can be. You know, like if I own a house, my house can be taken by the government, but my father's house cannot be. So it's not exactly the same, but the principle is there. You don't go after a family when one person has committed a crime. So again, giving the government face value, let's say that this kid is as dangerous as they want us to think he is. Let's say he was just a day from blowing up the Herald Square subway stop. You still don't go after his parents and his sister. Send them back to Pakistan where they are going to be tortured and persecuted most likely. The family apparently belongs to a sect of Islam that's considered very secular in Pakistan. And that is originally why they came to this country,
yeah,
because they had already been persecuted.
Isn't that an interesting irony? You point that out in your article, that this family was run out of Pakistan for being too secular.
That's right. That's right.
And they come here and the son is entrapped for a
terrorist being too Islamic.
Right.
Yes, this case abounds in irony all the way around, and it's easy to get caught up in all this irony, but again, we need to remember what this says about the federal government, about New York City government, about how out of control both are, and about what can happen to all of us, because eventually the war on terror is going to run out of Muslim Americans. You know, they'll either all be in jail or deported, or they'll have left on their own because they'll realize this is just not a place to be. What happens at that point? The government then starts coming after the rest of us.
What, right, with all the powers that they've gained fighting these other people with strange names.
That's right. And we are increasingly seeing government coming after us already. At the airports, most of the people who have been detained by the screeners at airports on various charges, these are all Americans. It's not Muslims. In fact, it's a riot. I get tons of email from people outraged at the Americans who are being detained instead of the Muslims. They apparently want the screeners only to screen Muslim passengers, and I sit there and just shake my head and think, don't you see what you're saying? You know, they're not going to screen just Muslim passengers. Any kind of right deprivation like this is going to be visited on all of us. It doesn't get confined.
Right, and now I know from your excellent articles for LouRockwell.com and from previous answers in this interview that you are very familiar with old English common law and the American Constitution and that sort of thing. So I wanted to bring up another thing that was mentioned in one of the articles you linked to about the case of this young man, Siraj. And that is that the government informant that testified against him, Mr. Eldawoody, that is in fact not his real name. And I wonder how that bears on the constitutionally protected right of all Americans to be able to face their accusers in court.
That's an excellent point. And, it, you know, again, we need to put ourselves in the place of this community. How would we feel if we were invaded this way? If somebody that we had been introduced to and thought of as a friend and knew for several years, all of a sudden we find out everything we're saying, everything we've been doing with this fellow, even where our cars are parked, this is all being reported to the FBI. I mean, this is an absolute outrage. There is no possible way this can be justified by any sense of fairness or any kind of constitutional authority. I've been very amused at the different debates that are going on here in the media in New York, whether or not the cops followed the rules on how to do this. And it's like, do you understand, if you've actually got rules on how to spy on citizens, there's something wrong right there. It doesn't matter if they went by the rules. Step back, look at it, and say, why are we living in a place that's allowing this? What's going on?
Well, and now the power is ultimately still in us. In these cases, I'm reminded of, I'm sorry, I forget the young man's name, hard to pronounce, hard to memorize, but a guy who worked at a gas station with one of the September 11th hijackers was recently acquitted. His first jury, it was 11-1 to convict him of, I believe, perjury was what they settled on after trying to call him a co-conspirator in the September 11th plot.
Right.
And there was one juror who adamantly refused to convict this kid.
Yes.
And so they tried again to prosecute him, and this time he was acquitted altogether.
Oh, that's great.
And so, you know, I would just consider that, you know,
that
something for potential jurors to put under their hat. And remember, if you vote to acquit somebody, no matter how bad the prosecutor wants you to convict them, they can't do anything to you for voting not guilty if you don't think he's guilty.
Yes, that is something for us to keep in mind, but unfortunately most Americans just don't realize this anymore. It's a lot like if a cop stops you prior to the passage of, the Supreme Court decision last summer, I think it was, that we now have to show ID to cops on demand. Prior to that, most Americans didn't realize that if a cop stops you, you don't have to give him ID. And so most Americans turned over their ID without question. It's the same thing with Americans on juries. Most Americans no longer understand what the function of a jury is. They think it's simply, I determine guilt or innocence based on what the government tells me. And they don't have your idea, which they should, that, you know what, I can stop injustice. I can stand here and say, no, it's not fair how you entrap this guy. And even if he's guilty, he gets a pass because of what you did to him. That whole idea is just gone. There's a tremendous amount of pressure that's brought to bear on juries to decide in the government's case. One of the things that's fascinating about this case is that the defense wanted to call Raymond Kelly, the police commissioner, and have him testify about how important this case was to him personally as far as establishing the credentials for his department. Now, the judge disallowed that, and that's not uncommon. This often will happen that a high-ranking government official who could shed light on some aspect of the defense's case is, you know, the defense tries to subpoena the official, and this is almost always denied because the courts are there to protect the state primarily, and we need to understand that, and we need to realize that we should stand up when we're on a jury, stand up against this. Don't let the government railroad an innocent person.
And, you know, another aspect of this, which is very troubling, as far as I can tell, there hasn't been a single real anti-terrorism prosecution in this country post 9/11, except perhaps Massawi, although the way that one was prosecuted sure wasn't very serious. But when we look back, there's the Detroit Five, there's the poor entrapped kid and his father from Lodi, California, the so-called Miami plot to blow up the Sears Tower, which was all the informant.
The Albany people.
Right, right. The Lackawanna Six.
Right.
The Virginia paintball guys who were told either plead guilty or we're going to call you enemy combatants and turn you over to the Navy.
Right.
And now we even find out that Jose Padilla was considered harmless
by
the FBI agent who originally arrested him, who tried to concoct a dirty bomb plot and put Padilla at the center of it.
That's right. I think what we need to do is follow the money. The war on terror is a tremendously expensive proposition, and it's got tons and tons of new bureaucracies to support. When you start putting through a department, the Department of Homeland Security alone, this for the year 2005, cost American taxpayers $47 billion. That's the Department of Homeland Security. That's not talking about the war in Iraq. We add the war in Iraq in, and we're up into figures like $250 billion on top of the 47.3.
Yeah, even more than that, really.
Yes, you're right, because that figure, actually, I just quoted with the $250 billion comes from February of 2006. I saw a more up-to-date figure this morning of $400 billion.
Right.
So we have, but I'm going to exclude the war right now. Let's just talk about here in the United States, and just looking at the Department of Homeland Security, you've got people making $47 billion a year. Untold bureaucrats, huge cushy offices, big important jobs. They run around telling the rest of us how they're protecting us. They have got to have something to protect us to.
Well, and in fact, contracts for favored companies is a big part of that too.
That's
the
right.
Corruption involved in awarding of those contracts.
You're absolutely right. Iraq has seen enormous corruption in the contractors that have come in to, quote, rebuild what we have destroyed.
I actually once met a guy who told me that his company makes the bomb-sniffing equipment for the airport and said that his company was the only one who their machine actually worked, which
right.
Who knows if that's even true. But, you know, his point was that none of the other stuff works at all. It's just a joke.
Well, you know, the other very interesting thing is you start investigating these companies' financial statements, and you'll find out often their contracts with Homeland Security will double or triple their revenues. So you not only have the direct government bureaucrats, and right now we're talking about an absolute army. There are 45,000 TSA screeners at the airports. So that's the lowest level. I'm not even talking now about the bureaucrats at the Department of Homeland Security. You add all of this in. Then you add in the companies that are making oodles off supplying the screening equipment, the uniforms, the badges and whistles and wands. You've got so many people making so much money. And remember what we're going after here, supposedly. We're going after guys that live in caves. So you've got a government out there with this enormous vested bureaucracy, all this taxpayer money that has been wasted. They have got to scare us silly and make us think there's an enemy out there worth all this. So it's just like the drug war. You've got little old ladies that need morphine to control their arthritis pain or whatever, and the government tries to tell us we're at danger from them. Like,
right.
I don't think so.
Well, and ultimately, you know, Bin Laden and Zawahiri escaped from Tora Bora, and, you know, chances are, particularly with the war in Iraq and the new generation of jihadists that have been trained and equipped there, that America truly does face a threat, as you pointed out earlier, from our continued interventionism and
right.
the blowback it creates. And when our government agencies are running around crying wolf all day, we're going to end up getting taken by surprise. These people are going to be crying wolf so loud they're not going to hear or see the attack coming.
That's absolutely correct. And the other thing that bothers me about this is Americans are very much like a guy being chased by a chihuahua who wanders or runs into a yard where Doberman Pinscher is. It's like, yeah, he's going to eat the chihuahua, but then he's going to come after you, buddy. We've got these little tiny guys living in caves trying to destroy the American way of life according to our government, and so we turn to the government to protect us. Well, boom, after the government gets done bombing the caves, they come after us because they've got all this power, all this money. They've got to keep it going. So it's fascinating, on a related tangent, to look at the TSA, the screeners at the airport, and what they have done there. There have been no terrorists uncovered by any TSA screener at any U.S.
And
airport.
And isn't that fascinating to consider? Of all the, what, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of friskings that have taken place. It's all been for naught so far.
That's right. There has not been a serious single, serious threat uncovered anywhere. Now,
I'm sorry, Becky, we're all out of time.
Oh, well, we just got on my favorite topic, too.
I'm sorry, yes, we're going to have to do a whole thing on the TSA, you and me, one day.
That sounds great, Scott. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you, everybody. Becky Akers, she writes for the extremely libertarian LouRockwell.com. This has been Anti-War Radio for January 15th, 2007. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And we'll be back here tomorrow from noon to 1 o'clock. Also, check out the archives at antiwar.com.